When the going gets tough, the tough get going to the kitchen for food. Then along comes the holiday season, and our escapism becomes an obsession that leads us to ask, how did we become a nation of foodies?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 706th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Perryopolis who are tuned in as we stream along on the radio page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Folks, today that we are broadcasting today, the 706th edition of the Food Chain, is testament, in a way, to the fact that we have indeed become a nation of foodies. How on earth did this happen? How did we become a nation of foodies? Here to help us cook up an answer, we have Dave DeWitt, author of The Founding Foodies, How Washington, Jefferson, and Franklin Revolutionized American Cuisine. Hello, David. Welcome to the Food Chain.
I'm happy to be here.
So, what is a foodie?
Well, you know, I wrestled with this because it's a pop word. You know, it's an invented word that came around in the 1980s. And Gail Green, the restaurant critic, actually coined the phrase. Then a book came out later on called The Official Foodie Handbook. And so that's been around for a long time, nearly 30 years. That term has been around. And the reason I chose it was I simply could not think of another term to describe the interest in food of historical figures. I mean, some of the things you think of, like epicure, gastronome, gourmand, they just didn't work within the overall context.
And foodies goes with founding, right?
Yeah.
There you go. Pretty
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it's alliterative, but beyond that, it sort of did describe what we would call a foodie today. I mean, these people were interested in, because they had really no other choice to grow things organically, and they, you know, they composted, they moved their crops around so that they wouldn't be in the same place all the time. They rotated them, in other words, and generally had kind of farming practices that we would call today sustainable. And so that being the part of the foodie ideal that is embraced, I just thought that would be a good title. Well, 20-some editors who rejected this book didn't think it was a very good title, obviously, and a former editor of mine who did reject it, and this is an editor I'd done a best-selling book with, she said, "How dare you demean Washington and Jefferson like this?" And I said, "Wait a minute. I'm not demeaning anybody. I'm raising them to a new level of humanity."
Amen to that.
And she wasn't buying that. But we finally found a home, and the great folks at Sourcebooks are you know, independent publishers. They're not associated with any of the big boys or anything like that. They, you know, they liked it. They thought, yeah, this is exactly right. And since they publish a lot of historical books about colonial and post-colonial times anyway, not food books, but this complemented some of the other books that they had done on Washington and Jefferson and that sort of thing.
Well, so, I, for one, and I know a lot of other people, love talking about food. I mean, you know, if you think about it, it's one of the, we talk about weather and we talk about food, and after that, we get into trouble, right?
So, right.
How did you become a foodie? You know, you were an English literature student, as was I. How did it happen to us that we ended up talking about food?
It all happened because I would hang out in the kitchen with my mother trying to avoid doing the dishes. And so if I helped prepare the food, I was exempt from dishwashing. And so that was the key. And then I got really interested, and I was just a prep cook for my mother. In other words, I would chop and peel and do all those things. But I learned, and by the time I was about 8 years old, I could prepare a complete meal for the entire family. And I also learned how to grill. My father was an early adopter of grilling. This was in the 50s. Had a little kettle charcoal thing, and I was responsible for doing a lot of the grilling because he was off drinking a beer.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things sort of collided. And then when I went to school, I was I was, you know, majoring in English. I was talking on the radio to work my way through the University of Virginia. And wherever we were, whoever my roommates are, I was always the cook because the best cook would become the cook. And so,
you just earned it.
Yeah,
you earned it as a foodie as you moved along up the academic ladder.
And you know, I was married a couple of times before my current wife, and I was always the cook in the family. I always planned all the meals, went to the stores, bought the food, prepared the food, put up the food, and all that kind of stuff. And then I met Mary Jane. And she was a better cook than I, so I relinquished.
Oh, happiness is, right?
Yeah, she's a baker, too, so, I mean, I've
there you go.
Died and gone to heaven.
So, Jefferson Franklin Washington, why did you settle on those founding foodies?
Well, they had the biggest names, for one thing, and they were legitimately interested in food. The big challenge was finding all this information, and that's why it took me 3.5 years to research and write
this book. Why did it take so long?
Well, because I kept learning new things.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, if I were writing about chili peppers, of which I've already done 30-some books on that subject, I wouldn't have any problem. I'd know exactly where to go to find all the information, but when you're dealing with something that I was not an expert in, namely colonial and post-colonial food and cooking, I had to, I don't know, it was like writing a doctoral dissertation. Or
so something brand new. Now, now that you know so, you've told us that you know so much about chili peppers. Were there chili peppers in the colonial cuisine?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Both Washington and Jefferson were growing chili peppers. Both cayenne and bird peppers, they called them, the little piquin type peppers. They grew them in their gardens. They occasionally used them. A dish called pepper pot, which came from the Caribbean, became very, very popular in Philadelphia, for example, and is still cooked there to this day. And so,
what is pepper pot?
Pepper pot is a soup that cooks forever in the sense that in the Caribbean, people would keep pots of it going for days, weeks, sometimes
just
years.
Keep adding stuff to it.
Yeah,
right?
Just okay. Kept adding new stuff to it all the time, and that was adopted. You know, in the Philadelphia area, and there's plenty of pepper pot recipes out there. But it's essentially a spicy, thick Caribbean stew, I guess you'd say.
Something warm for cold nights.
Yeah.
Going forever.
Yeah, so there were some chili peppers, but they weren't, you know, a major part of the cuisine. Generally, the use of chili peppers was more common among the slaves or African Americans in their cooking, which also profoundly influenced the way American food developed, and I cover that somewhat in
quite,
the book.
Quite a bit, too.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back before we revolutionize the food. What was the food that needed to be revolutionized?
Well,
it seems like our founding fathers and mothers, the people who were the first here, were kind of clueless when it came to feeding themselves.
Well, they were at first. that's because when the settlement was made both in Jamestown and up in the, you know, Cape Cod area and so forth. The people who were settling had no experience hunting, fishing, trapping, cooking. They didn't have any. These were just people who were adventurers, basically looking for gold or other valuable things.
So they're kind of like city people, right?
Yeah, they were. They were all city people, as a matter of fact, and they weren't farmers, and so they had to learn everything from scratch, which meant many of them starved to death. And if it weren't for
learning the hard way.
Yeah, if it weren't for corn, I mean maize, it was mm-hmm. called then. We call it corn, which is a misnomer because all grain crops were called corn. If it weren't for corn and actually Native Americans helping out the Jamestown colony, it would have gone, you know, completely under.
So that's one of the founding stories, really, isn't it? How the Indians came to the settlers and said, "Look, dummy,
right?
This is how you survive." And they introduced corn. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, corn, of course, is a uniquely New World crop that spread from its basic area development in Mexico. It spread south into South America and north into North America. So, gradually, the small teosinte kind of corn had cobs about the size of, you know, the end of your thumb. And gradually, through, you know, plant selection, the larger cobs were were chosen, and over the millennia, it evolved into the corn we know now. It was a staple, and the three, you know, main staples, you know, were, of course, corn and squash, and then some other ones that, you know, people like to talk about and so forth, but weren't commonly used, the tomatoes and those kinds of things. But it was mostly corn and squash that were being grown by Native Americans all over the Americas, and they were the basic staples of life. And so it was natural to show the new settlers who were clueless not only how to eat corn, but how to catch fish. And my gosh, there's this thing called an oyster.
And we're going to pick that up when we come right back.
Okay,
we'll pick
sure.
up that oyster. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the founding foodies, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, how they revolutionized the food of our young nation and turned us all into foodies. Right back with Dave DeWitt, author of The Founding Foodies.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, when those pilgrims landed here in the fresh, brand new United States, they didn't really know what the heck they were doing and ended up kind of living on ship's biscuit, which was no fun at all.
No.
And yet, there they were in a paradise of food. Right, Dave DeWitt?
Well, yeah. I mean, the woods were teeming with game, everything from wild turkeys to deer, and, of course, the usual small creatures, the birds and the rabbits and so forth. And then, of course, on the coast where these settlements first took place, there was all kinds of seafood and fish and
mountains of oysters.
Yeah, but they didn't know what to do with them. And they thought a lot of it was disgusting. I mean,
wow.
I can imagine if the first time you ever see a raw oyster, you may not think it's the most, you know, wonderful-looking thing you've ever seen.
You know, the first time I had a raw oyster was on the radio.
Oh.
It was kind of fun.
I used to eat raw oysters until I had food poisoning one time, and I never ate another one.
Yep, so, it happens like that.
Yeah, I just I can't bring myself to eat a raw one any longer, but I do eat them cooked and so forth. So anyway, they had to learn, and you know what happened was they were depending on supplies coming from England,
right,
on the ships, and the ships would often be late. They would be blown off course. Sometimes they'd be sunk, and then the food never got to the outposts in the New World, so they were in big trouble. But you know, they did learn, and part of the problem they were having was, look at all this corn, the Indians have it over here, let's go take it. And that led to wars and problems and, you know, just all kinds of stuff. So,
right. But the Indians did, in fact, teach them how to grow corn and how to use fertilizer and how to use companion planting even.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that the debates rage on. Did the settlers, especially the ones up, you know, the Plymouth Colony and that sort of thing, did they learn from the Indians to put a fish in the mound where they were going to place the kernel of corn to grow it? Well, sometimes probably. And did they learn it from the Indians? Probably, but not everybody could use that because not everybody had a ready supply of fish, especially
right.
The further inland you went, it was more difficult to have the fish. And so there was mostly letting the fields go fallow was the way
of doing it.
Yeah, that was probably 90% of it. But these legends, what the food historian Andrew F. Smith calls culinary fake lore, just is all over the place, and it took me quite a while to sort out what was true from what was fake.
Right, right. You know, one of the more fascinating accounts in the story was how food on the hoof was introduced to the young country in the form of pigs, right?
Yeah, well, there's millions of pigs running wild in Texas and the
right.
deep South, and they all came from the Spanish explorers who brought pigs along to feed the men. And so the pigs would be aboard these ships and would be fed scraps and whatever would, keep mm-hmm. them alive. And then, of course, once they were released, they went native, and they started breeding and all that kind of stuff. And even Washington and Jefferson, they had pigs, but they ran wild because they were eating the acorns in the forest.
They could feed themselves.
Yeah, and then the slaves would go round them up, and they'd slaughter a bunch of them, but, of course, they couldn't catch all of them.
Right.
And this led to the enormous population of wild boars that we have, in Texas especially today. And they're quite a game animal, some people say.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of them even found their way all the way out here to California as well. But
I'm sure they did.
I think they were brought out here.
They probably were.
Yeah. But they became quite a source of food then.
Yes. Yes, they did. And led to the whole pork industry in the United States. And the great thing about them was they didn't have to do anything. In other words, they didn't have to raise them. They didn't have to raise hay and cut the hay and feed the animals and so forth like that. They were foraging. The concept that pigs will eat anything is pretty much true.
Now, a huge piece of the equation here in early agriculture and early foodism were the slaves, of course, because without them, there would not have been an agriculture. Is that true?
Right. Absolutely, because it required people to do the planting, do the harvesting, and do the weeding and whatever was necessary, not only in fields of crops, but also, of course, in home gardens where a lot of the food was raised for the particular families. And the slaves became a part of the entire agricultural enterprise of any plantation. And, of course, there were good plantation owners and there were bad plantation owners. As it turns out, both Washington and Jefferson, for their time, were rather benevolent. I ran across no instances of any slaves being beaten or tortured or anything like that on these two large plantations in Virginia. As a matter of fact, Jefferson in particular was revered by his slaves because when Jefferson was around, the overseers couldn't be mean to the slaves, and so they loved it when he came back. As a matter of fact, when he came back from his term as president, they were partying down like crazy at Monticello. Both
they're very happy.
Yeah,
happy to have them there.
Yeah,
I once did a radio show from the area. I was trying to get up to Monticello to do my food chain show one Saturday morning, and fell short and ended up in a little town called Gum Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And Gum Springs evidently was where most of Jefferson's slaves lived at the time. I don't know whether that's true or not, but an attendant at the local gas station told me that was the case. But fascinating stuff. Slaves made it possible to really develop a monoculture of tobacco. Tobacco became what, the first real cash crop of the United States?
Yes, it did, but it was not long to be. I mean, it's still going on now in various niche areas and so forth, but the whole tobacco industry sprung up to export it to England. And, of course, when you're going to start exporting, then you've got everybody saying, yeah, I want my piece of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so the taxation was enormous. The transportation costs, the commissions to the brokers who would handle the sale of the tobacco in England was very high. And it was a monocultural crop, which meant it was susceptible to, any kind of disease or pest could wipe out whole fields and that sort of thing. And also, it was very intensely labor-oriented because not only did you have to grow it and you had to cut it, it had to be cured in specifically the right manner. Otherwise, it had no value.
And that's something that Washington was sitting down when he went back to his farm and looked at, well, what am I going to do to make money here? He looked at the tobacco and said, hey, I'm not making any money here because I have to pay out 80% of the crop.
Right. And that's why he switched to grain crops. like wheat, but he didn't just grow wheat and sell raw wheat to people.
He had to add some value, right?
Yeah, he needed to add on value, so he built a threshing barn, and they threshed the wheat, and then he ended up having the first automated flour mill in the United States, which was a new invention, and the patent for that was patent number 3 issued by the United States, and the patent commissioner was Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson, yeah.
So we're really starting
to get into that sense that these guys really were revolutionary.
Yeah.
Back quickly to some of the crops. Cod and salt. Cod and salt.
That built New England right there. First it was cod and catching cod, and that led to the invention of the schooner, which was the first real ship that was designed for cod fishing, because it had movable masts, so it could catch the wind when the wind would shift and so forth, and it was a smaller vessel but faster. And imagine trying to, in the rough seas around Cape Cod and so forth, imagine going out in a three-masted ship or something like that. You couldn't do any maneuvering at all.
Nothing but trouble.
When the schooner was invented, that really helped the entire industry. And, of course, salt was essential because how was meat preserved? How is fish preserved? The only way to do it was dry it or salt it. That was the only methods they had. And so during the Revolutionary War
let's pick up Sleepy John Sears when we come back.
Okay,
and
sure.
Talk about how he invented, essentially, a way of getting salt out of water. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're looking at the founding foodies of our nation, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, how they revolutionized American cuisine and established a tradition of foodies that we carry on today. Right back. Well, folks, when the going gets tough, the tough get going to the kitchen for some food. And we're talking food today, the founding foodies, how Washington, Jefferson, and Franklin revolutionized American cuisine, as outlined in that book of that same title by Dave DeWitt. Dave's here with us today. We're talking a little bit about the principal crops of the early colonialists in the United States, and one of them we talked about just about cod and salt, and how we were going to talk a little bit about how Sleepy John Sears invented a solar salt maker that really was the key to developing the industry, right, Dave?
Yeah, it was, because during the Revolutionary War, salt was as important as bullets to the army, because you had to feed the army, and there had to be a way to feed the army, and so the salt was in much demand, and everybody was trying to figure out a way to do it, mostly by boiling seawater. But Sears had this idea that the sun could do it, even in Massachusetts, believe it or not. And so he invented essentially a technique that spread the salt water out in trays and put it in the sun and just let it dry. It was very simple. We call it, you know, solar, but I mean, it was a basic thing.
Evaporation, yeah.
It beat the heck out of boiling, because what did boiling require? Wood like crazy.
Right, yeah.
And so all the forests were being denuded
to get
the salt. So he did great. And
and because of that, you know, cod became a huge industry.
It did, and most of the cod later on, and fish in general, not just cod, but further down in Virginia, it was herring and shad. These were salted and then shipped to the Caribbean and traded for, say, molasses, a rum-making ingredient.
Oh, molasses, that brings up the next big crop, which is rum.
Yes, and
America's first hard stuff, right?
Well, it was, in the sense that it was the first distilled beverage produced in the United States, using techniques that came starting first, actually, in Barbados. The Mount Gay rum distillery is believed to be the first in the Caribbean. I've actually visited that distillery. It's utterly fascinating. And it's still being produced today.
Wow.
So what would happen would be, instead of bringing the rum back, they bring the molasses back and then make it themselves. And Medford, Massachusetts became the center of rum making in the United States, and that was pretty darn interesting. And then, of course, rum fell out of fashion after the Revolutionary War. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with anything perceived to be English. So that's when the whiskey industry started, and once again, Washington was on top of things. If you're going to make flour as an added-on value to wheat, why not make some whiskey?
And that's a big story. We're going to pick that up in a little bit. But back to New England for one more crop.
Okay, sure.
Pepper.
Oh, yeah.
Pepper in New England?
Yeah, that was a real surprise. But once again, it was the schooners that were responsible for this because they could go so fast. And in other words, classically, there was trade between India and England, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the black pepper came from. But the entrepreneurs up there in Salem, Massachusetts, figured out that they could take the schooners, make a fast run to India, bring it back to the United States, and then export it to England. And it was a huge industry. And it lasted right up until the time that, right before the War of 1812, the British were raiding American ships. And it made Thomas Jefferson, who was the president, so mad, he issued a total embargo on all ships leaving ports from the United States. You can imagine how many industries and livelihoods it just was ruinous to America.
So for those of us who are considering not trading with the rest of the world, that's a good example of what happens when we shut things down, right?
Yeah, the wheat could not be exported because a lot of it was still being exported. Tobacco could not be exported. Nobody could do any trading. And the thing was, America couldn't even trade with itself by ships running back up and down the coast from New England to Virginia, say. That was prohibited as well for fear of the British raids. And, everybody says, what a wonderful genius Thomas Jefferson was. But,
he seemed to be a genius, but not a very good farmer.
He wasn't a good farmer, and he wasn't a good president, and he certainly was a terrible governor of Virginia.
But he was a great writer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not demeaning his accomplishments, but the problem was he was a polymath, which, of course, is a fancy word for genius. And he had so many different interests. I mean, he could play musical instruments. He was an architect. He was a plant experimenter of the highest order. And he was a writer and a researcher and a historian, just name it. It just goes on, all his accomplishments. But and he was a good politician in the sense that he could get elected. However, he did not do very well after he got the positions of power that he was looking for.
So let's follow Jefferson to Paris, where he was, Secretary of State, I think?
Well, he was an ambassador.
Ambassador.
Yeah, he was not quite the Secretary of State because that had not been invented yet, but he was an ambassador, and he was sent there to take over for Benjamin Franklin, mm-hmm. which is exactly what he did.
And this, of course, is a very important relationship for the young country, too.
Yes, because we were trying to get money from France
exactly.
all the time.
Right.
Even after the Revolutionary War had wound down, don't forget the War of 1812.
Maybe that's what Jefferson was best at, was sales.
He was a good salesperson, there's no doubt about that. And he was also very good, quick thinker on his feet and so forth like that, and he was able to do things like smuggle rice out of Italy, which was a capital offense.
And the reason he did that?
Oh, because he had some friends in South Carolina, and he thought, they're growing rice, this is a better kind of rice, they'll love this, but they didn't.
They didn't like it.
No.
But he was very good at selecting good foods from around the world. And his tour of duty, as it were, as an ambassador in Paris, was really what set him off.
Well, yeah. I mean, he had everything he'd ever want. I mean, the creditors couldn't get to him there. He had...
and he owed a lot of money, too, of
yes,
course.
Yes, he did.
And that's a big reason why he accepted the position, to get
right.
the heck out of Dodge, because
that's
they
it.
Owed so much money. Yeah,
yeah, and also he had a salary, which was... He needed a salary. He really needed the money. And then, of course, a lot of his expenses were paid in Paris, and so he lived very, very well. And he had brought his slave, James Hemings, who was Sally Hemings' brother, with him and paid for his training as a, to become a certified French chef.
French chef.
So the first American ever to become a French chef was a slave.
Now, he was a free man, though, in Paris.
He was a free man in Paris because under French law, there was no slavery. So anybody who was called a slave in the United States, as soon as they set foot on French soil, became free.
Free.
However, that doesn't mean that blacks were beloved in Paris. They had the same kind of prejudices against them that anybody did. However, if someone was really talented, like James Hemings, the color of your skin didn't matter.
Right.
If you could cook, that was all. And so he became the maitre d'hôtel of the Hotel Langeac, where Jefferson was actually staying. And so,
hey, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back,
sure.
I'd like to talk with you about how Jefferson tried to use maple sugar to end slavery. Okay?
Okay.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're having some fun talking about the Founding Foodies with Dave DeWitt, the author of The Founding Foodies, and you. Pick up your phones and join us. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Dave DeWitt, author of The Founding Foodies, How Washington, Jefferson, and Franklin Revolutionized American Cuisine. How did Jefferson try to free the slaves with maple sugar?
Well, someone said, I haven't quite tracked down the quote, I think it might have been Peter Hatch, the guy who runs the grounds at Monticello. I think he said, Thomas Jefferson never met a plant he didn't like. And that was so true. And so Jefferson would get crushes on plants, like we might get a crush on a certain type of food or a young lady or something like that. He was just hot to trot on maples, getting maples established everywhere to get the maple syrup, which could be refined into maple sugar. And
thus competing with the cane sugar from
Caribbean. Yeah, and the idea was if they could compete in the United States, not only would we not have to import sugar from the Caribbean, then the slaves could be freed because their labor was no longer needed. This was pie in the sky to the ultimate degree. And, of course, the big whole plan with, you know, the sugar maples and so forth just did not work. And the sugar maple industry stayed with syrup like it is today, which is still wonderful. I had a friend of mine in Vermont send me about a half quart of it. It's delicious.
It is delicious. Let's pick up a phone call. Folks, phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with the Founding Foodies and Dave DeWitt. James, welcome to The Food Chain.
Oh, thanks, Michael. Yeah, Mike. Question for the author is, since you're talking about Jefferson and his endeavors with plants, how does the hemp plant in your research factor into Jefferson's life, and what were his findings in terms of nutrition or, because it had a lot of applications and it was so necessary for that time period to use that plant for various resources, but how would it work with food? Did he actually do anything in that area? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Good question.
Is a good question, and the answer is Jefferson and his contemporaries would no more eat hemp than they would eat hay. I mean, that's what it was viewed like. It was not a food plant. It was a industrial plant.
They all grew it too, didn't they?
Well, both Washington and Jefferson grew it, and they grew it to make clothing and make rope mostly.
Right.
Mostly used for rope, especially George Washington because of his fishing operation, which needed rope all the time. Lines, they call it in the sea vernacular. But they needed to make lines, and the hemp made great lines for tying off boats and holding on to nets and all kinds of things. And so yes, they were all growing it, but it wasn't any big deal. It was not psychoactive or anything, I don't think it ever occurred to anybody to eat it.
It's kind of interesting in reading The Founding Foodies. It seems as though that Washington was every bit as successful as Jefferson was not at farming.
That's true. I mean, it also had to do with I don't know. One person phrased it, Jefferson just had a lot of bad luck. And it was true. I mean, if you look at, say, farming in southern New Mexico, growing of chili peppers and, mm-hmm. and pecans and all the other crops we grow down there, there'll be one farmer whose yields all the time are just spectacular, and then the farmer down the road who can't even do half of that.
And that would have been Jefferson.
Yeah, it would have been Jefferson.
And Washington was just seemed to be a success at whatever enterprise he picked up. And he picked up so many different enterprises for Mount Vernon's 8,000
acres. Yeah, that was the fun part, was discovering all that. And so then the question comes up, who was the founder of modern agriculture? Was it Washington or Jefferson? Jefferson is given that title. And I just rephrase the whole thing, and I think that Washington was actually the founding father of agriculture, and Jefferson was the founding father of gardening.
Well, there you go. Let's pick up another phone call. Let's go to Rich. Rich, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, a couple of questions. Unless I missed it, did Jefferson or the others have anything to do with the wine industry?
And ooh, really, boy.
And the other question was, what about their wives? How did they enter into it with the food and their recipes and what they cook?
Good question.
Oh, they're both good questions. Both Washington and Jefferson attempted to establish vineyards.
They both had a wonderful taste for French wines.
They did. As a matter of fact, Jefferson advised Washington regularly on what kinds of wines he should buy, and included Washington's orders and his orders that went, you know, over to Paris and Italy and that sort of thing for wine. But the dream, of course, was to have a wine industry in Virginia, and so they both tried, and they both failed. And the problem was they would get imported stock from both France and Italy and plant it, and it was totally susceptible to American pests. And so the vineyards would live for a while, and then they'd just die. And this was before they realized they had to graft the grapes that came from overseas onto American rootstock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really launched the industry, but that came about after Washington and Jefferson. Now, in terms of the question about wives, well, Martha Washington basically ran the house. I mean, she was in charge of the house, and so she directed the food making in the kitchens at Mount Vernon and used an old recipe book that came from England as the basis of most of the cooking there, of course, which had been altered by the different crops and the different foods that were available in the colony.
Can you hold for a sec? We'll pick that up when we get back. Rich, can you hang with us?
Sure. Yeah, I have one more question.
Okay, good. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Dave DeWitt and Rich about the founding foodies, how Washington, Jefferson, and Franklin revolutionized American cuisine. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Phone numbers 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. I am Michael Olson, and I look forward to talking with you. Well, when it came to running kitchens, I guess Martha Washington was the one who ran George's outfit at Mount Vernon there. But when it came to Monticello, it was the slave Hemmings, correct, Dave?
Yes, he did it, and then his brother did it, and then Edith, who was another very talented cook, she took over, Edith Fawcett, and she took over. And essentially, they knew exactly how to do everything. And Jefferson's wife had died, and so there was no woman of the house until his daughters grew up. So the slaves took over and did a great job. And it seemed like it was perfectly normal. And you know, we have a stereotypical idea of what slave life was like, and the Simon Legree with a whip image comes around all the time. But really, it was like a small town that Monticello had there with blacks and whites freely intermingling, interacting. Yes, they lived apart, but there were some of the slaves, Sally Hemmings, lived right underneath Jefferson's.
Oh, you don't want to go that direction, do you?
Well, no. everything I wrote about that was cut out of the book, so no
okay.
Need to bring it up. But
all right.
the point being that the slaves had access to everywhere. And it was no segregation as we would think of it. Segregation came later. I mean, but everybody had to work together to feed everybody and clothe everybody and all that kind of stuff. And so Jefferson many times referred to his slaves as his family. And as I mentioned, I couldn't find any instance of any mistreatment by Jefferson or by Washington. This is not to say that the overseers did not, at some point in time, mistreat them.
Rich, got a follow-up?
Yeah, a comment. First, though, you know, this is one of the best programs you've had, because you've got so much interesting historical tidbits of information on real what real people were like and the failures and successes. And, you, I mean, you've crammed so much into this. It's great. I really appreciate this program. My last question is, because we have Thanksgiving coming up, did they have anything to do with the cranberry industry? Also, wild turkeys obviously roam the hills. Did they try to do anything with domesticating them?
Thank you for the call, Rich.
Yes, both Washington and Jefferson had domesticated turkeys. The habits of eating turkeys at Thanksgiving and Christmas developed later, but that's not to say they weren't cooked there, because there were recipes for them, and roasted turkey was commonly served, as was roasted chicken, and that sort of thing. The cranberry industry developed in New England after colonial times, so there wasn't really much of that going on. And as far as the holidays go, I'm going to be on NPR getting closer to Christmas talking about a colonial Christmas. And the same thing sort of applies for Thanksgiving. Yes, there was a day of Thanksgiving, but it was not official. It was generally celebrated in November.
Hey, you know, we didn't even get to Franklin, who was one of my favorite people in history. But he did leave us with something from the founding foodies, how Washington, Jefferson, and Franklin revolutionized American cuisine, by Dave DeWitt. And this from Benjamin Franklin. Beer is living proof that God loves us and wants us all to be happy.
Yes, and you're the second host in 2 days who has quoted that same line. So that's great, yes. He was very influential, but a lot of times what he wrote was not what he practiced in real life.
Okay, Dave, we're out of time, but I really want to thank you for joining us today. The Founding Foodies, a great read. Pick it up and enjoy it. It is, after all, the holiday season, so enjoy it.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.